You're listening to local and regional news on KMUN. I'm Ava Berardi. Climate Week just wrapped up in the Pacific Northwest, with hundreds of events in Washington, Oregon, and British Columbia. A hot topic this year was AI data centers and their impact on the grid. KNKX environment reporter Bellamy Palethorpe has more.
Climate Week brings together innovators, researchers, and policymakers. James Hovey is with the nonprofit advocacy group Climate Solutions. He spoke at a discussion about AI data centers and communities and said he was surprised by the willingness of big tech and utilities on the panel to consider regulations, like requiring disclosure of projected water and electricity use.
Everyone on the panel talked about data transparency and flexibility and those things, and those we believe are critical for our grid planning and for transparency so we know ratepayers aren't being hurt. So it was great to hear that.
A spokeswoman for Microsoft said the company supports transparency and tariffs to make sure data centers are paying their way. The company's sustainability report shows a 25% increase in its greenhouse gas emissions last year. I'm Bellamy Palethorpe reporting.
This is news on KMUN. I'm Katie Frankowitz. For three weekends this spring, a group of 29 randomly selected Snohomish County residents were tasked with crafting guidelines for how the county should use artificial intelligence. It's a model known as Civic Assembly that aims to empower everyday people in policymaking. KNFX Murrow News fellow Nate Sanford followed the entire process. In part two of our series, Nate takes us inside the final recommendations produced by the group.
The participants in the Civic Assembly spent the first two weekends hearing from experts, researching AI issues, and working together to come up with a list of shared values. During the third weekend in early June, they met for a final time at Washington State University's Everett campus to put the ideas into actual policy recommendations for the county. Many participants came into the assembly with strong feelings for and against AI, but some say their views have shifted as they talked with other members. Assemblymember Drew Vrijtita is a software engineer who frequently uses AI in his job. He sees it as a helpful tool, but he's come to appreciate the need for guardrails.
You know, I think my thought process has grown and to incorporate all the other social and other equitable aspects that I didn't come in, you know, originally thinking about.
Hillary Morales describes herself as a bit of a Luddite and didn't want the county to use AI at all.
I initially went in hoping I could basically just stop everything, which I understand is completely not an option. But what it really did was it helped me to better understand other people's thoughts and usages and processes.
As the final weekend drags on, there are still some disagreements that need to be ironed out, like whether or not county employees should be allowed to use AI to respond to emails from constituents. We'll get to that in a minute. A few participants say they're frustrated by the narrow scope of the Civic Assembly. Jessica Rhodes says she wanted more time to talk about data centers and the environmental impacts of AI.
They have been very dismissive about all of our environmental concerns, and every time someone brings up a concern, they're like, well, we're talking about this subject, so let's get back on point. We'll have time to talk about that later.
Rhodes and a few other participants broke off and ended up writing up a list of environmental recommendations on their own time. After some back and forth, the facilitators agreed to include them as a separate appendix in the final report.
Water restrictions, energy regulation, required to, you know, supply their own energy for these data centers, required to not be able to use eminent domain.
On the final day of the assembly, the participants prepared to vote on which recommendations to pass on to the county. Snohomish County Councilmember Jared Mead shows up to watch.
Some of the ideas are probably going to be crazy and unimplementable and too expensive and all the things. And some of them are going to be awesome. Awesome ideas that we could not have thought of.
Any other questions before we vote?
Jillian Youngblood, the lead facilitator, reads off each recommendation as the voting begins.
1.4, the county should only use AI if, after considering the scale of the problem or the efficiency, accuracy, and accountability, the tool is the best solution.
Participants use their phones to vote anonymously. Each recommendation needs at least 80% to pass.
The recommendation passes.
35 recommendations pass with strong support. The participants decide that county staff can use AI to respond to emails, but they have to disclose it. The group also recommends that the county should ensure humans are always the final decision makers and make it clear to residents anytime they're interacting with an AI communication system. One recommendation was that the county should not use AI to replace human employees. This did not pass. Participant Jessica Rhodes says there was a lot of debate.
There is a really big discussion. The reality is that we can't feasibly justify making employers retain every single employee that they have while also paying for this new, you know, artificial intelligence system that does the job of all of their employees?
After voting wraps up, the participants exchange numbers, say goodbye, and take a group photo.
Why do you say democracy?
Some say they're now planning to attend future council meetings. Assembly participant Theo Moriarty is a middle school teacher. He says he hopes other jurisdictions in Washington will be inspired to try their own civic assemblies.
There isn't a lot of trust in America for government and corporations, especially government and corporations working together. This sort of thing and the resolutions from it, I think, could go a long way to forming a baseline of trust.
The recommendations are now being delivered to the county council for consideration. At least one county council member says the county probably won't be able to adopt all the recommendations, but the hope is that they can turn as many as possible into law. I'm Nate Sanford, reporting.
Employees of the Nippon Dynawave Paper Mill in Longview, Washington, will continue to be paid through at least October 11th. Much of the mill has been closed since May, when a massive tank spilled caustic chemicals, killing 11 employees. The company had previously guaranteed pay to furloughed workers through August 8th. State and federal investigations into the cause of the implosion continue. The company notified employees of the pay extension on Friday. In a press release, a spokesperson for the Association of Western Pulp and Paper Workers said the extension, quote, represents another positive step in providing stability for the dedicated employees and families who have already endured so much. Seattle-based photographer Keely Yuyen has a new book out. It's a global exploration of traditional ecological knowledge. With striking photos, the book shows Native communities all around the world who have kept their cultures alive through conservation. Essays from those places explain how. The book is called Guardians of Life, Indigenous Knowledge, Indigenous Science, and Restoring the Planet. KNKX environment reporter Bellamy Palethorpe brought its maker into their studio to learn more.
Keely Yuyen, you are a photographer and a builder of Indigenous kayaks, also a National Geographic explorer. First, tell us about the kayaks. What are they made of, and where did your interest in building them come from?
Well, kayaks, the way that they're built is they're essentially made from a driftwood frame and then covered over with skin. Sometimes that is bark, but a lot of times it is marine mammal skins. Mm-hmm. For me, a lot of it is finding my way home. Like, I wasn't born and raised in my community, so I spent much of my life trying to find my way back to my grandmother's community. And being embraced by all of these indigenous cultures. And I try my best to just listen and learn and try to absorb and be a part of that community. And for me, it fills this place in my psyche and my soul that I really have needed. And it's made me grow in wonderful ways.
And you're also a really renowned photographer now. So how did that happen? Why photography?
Yeah, I don't know about renowned, but I will say that you know, I started as a kayak builder and became a photographer, and it was sort of a natural flow, natural extension. You know, one of the things that was happening a lot, too, is that as a kayak builder, I kept being in front of the camera because commercial companies would come to me like Land Rover, you know, and they would be like, wait, your story is really unique. We would love to, do this little story about you. And I started to realize that this was a way to reach out and talk about culture to people in a way that was very real and authentic. And I started to go down that road.
Mm-hmm. And taking photographs, I think you've said, is also a really good way to just capture a feeling.
Yeah, it needs to grab you and seize you in a way by the heart, whether that's long or slow. It's really important that people feel something.
Yeah, in the natural world in particular, I would think, because that leads to people maybe caring about it and wanting to preserve it.
Yeah, I think that there is a combination of different feelings. You know, I'm not ever trying to beat people over the head with like feel this way or think this way. But people can't help but look at some of these beautiful landscapes and the people living with them and get the deeper message, which is that humans in the landscape belong together.
Your new book is called Guardians of Life. And the central driving question in it, you've said, is why are indigenous communities so often so good at conservation? You answer it in this book by exploring 9 locations with indigenous people, from Alaska to Ecuador, Mongolia to Greenland, California to Vancouver Island, and more. Where did your curiosity about this question come from?
You know, it started when I was in Alaska working with the Inupiat. I went up there actually to advance my knowledge of kayak building. And when I was up there, I realized that the people up there, the Inupiat, were hunting whales. And I fell in love with that community and started spending time around them. And I very quickly realized that they did amazing things. Like, they were able to take the population of whales into their care and then triple the population of whales in just 30 years' time. So when I realized that hardly anyone knew about this story, I started to look deeper into traditional ecological knowledge and how it is that indigenous peoples were so good at this. But the other thing was, like, looking around and realizing that most of the world's most beautiful places actually have people living in them. And it wasn't in spite of the people living in them, it was because of the people living in them, which is, for me, it was quite a revelation. Like, I sort of knew it intellectually, but to feel it in my heart was different.
Mm. And that is the first chapter of your book, Alaska, Recovering Whales, is the title of the first chapter. And I'll say it again, the Inupiat people used indigenous knowledge to triple the bowhead whale population there in just 30 years. And this was in the face of international regulations that had locked them out of their traditional whaling process. So, you know, how did they do this? And how did they maintain their hunting culture?
Well, yeah, it's kind of a long story, but the short of it essentially was that the way that they manage their whales is by having this deep-seated knowledge and then having the elders and the elder hunters who would get together in these hunting councils and talk about the guidelines for how to hunt them, how to manage them. And some of those things are very much adaptations to the modern world. For example, they fought offshore oil drilling because they didn't want the sounds of motorboats, especially during the whale migration. There are lots of other things, like they learned how to not hunt pregnant whales. So they've known for a long time how to identify a pregnant whale just by looking at it from the surface, which I will tell you, is an amazing feat. Yeah. Over time, I've slowly been able to see whether a whale is male or female. This is over, like, you know, 15 years, and I'm still wrong a lot. But being able to see a pregnant whale and be able to see the differences between particular types of whales and their age and all of that, unbelievable.
So essentially by knowing the whales, truly knowing them, is a big part of how they managed to bring them back.
Knowing the whales. And also they do a thing that we call two-eyed seeing. This was a phrase coined by a Mi'kmaq elder not that long ago, but it's the idea that you use science with one eye and traditional ecological knowledge with the other eye. And when you use two eyes with both eyes open, you gain depth perception. You gain something more than just using both eyes. You know.
I love that. And there are so many great stories and locations in this book. So what is the answer to the big question, though? Why are indigenous communities so often so good at conservation?
I think at the core of it is that all of these communities have one thing. They have place-based knowledge, and they have a place-based love. And what does place-based means? It means that they have all of these systems that have evolved over thousands of years of being in a single place that is home. So they take care of it in a way that means they're home. They're not migratory. They're not leaving to other places when the going gets hard or whatever. This is their home and they're taking care of it, right? And you see this kind of thing happening. Like, a great example of it is in the Amazon, for example. The Pink River Dolphin, you have where one tributary of the Amazon has no Pink River Dolphins left and another one where it does. You have one community. They're culturally very similar, right? The one community on one bank, one river, essentially is secular. You know, they were Christianized, and then over time they became secular and stopped believing in religion altogether. And the other river, you have the people that believe that the Pink River Dolphin is where children come from, that it's a spirit visitor in the night. And the ones where they became secular, they stopped seeing the Pink River Dolphin as a spiritual being and a protector, and instead it turned into meat. And so they started to hunt the dolphin, and pretty soon there's no dolphins, whereas in the neighboring river, there's plenty of dolphins.
Keely Yuyen, thank you so much for joining me. He's a National Geographic explorer, Seattle-based photographer, and his new book is out now. It's called Guardians of Life. I'm Bellamy Palethorpe, KNKX News.
You're listening to local and regional news on KMUN. Now moving to news from Oregon. A crew made up of firefighters from Lincoln, Linn, and Tillamook counties is headed to East Evans Creek Fire near Medford. The Oregon State Fire Marshal requested the group, known as Strike Force 7, to report to the fire. The group includes firefighters from North Lincoln, Depot Bay, Albany, Harrisburg, and Neatart's Oceanside Fire Departments. Depot Bay Fire Chief Tom Jackson says this is the second group of firefighters he sent to work on this fire.
We may end up seeing some extra work and some overtime and maybe long hours, but we always make sure that we backfill those vacancies so that we don't necessarily see a drawdown of resources here locally.
The East Evans Creek fire started last Friday and has burned nearly 12,000 acres and prompted various levels of evacuation notices for about 8,000 people, mostly in Jackson County. Ashland air quality got worse overnight because of the East Evans Creek fire. Experts are encouraging people to use caution if they are outdoors. JPR's Peyton Gast reports on resources to help stay informed about smoke.
Experts are saying to stay inside well-ventilated spaces amid these smoky conditions. If you do have outdoor activities planned, take precautions such as wearing an N95 mask. Ashland Emergency Manager Kelly Burns says the air quality in Ashland is unhealthy right now.
You can look outside and you can taste and smell the smoke.
Burns recommends checking the Air Now and Purple Air websites. He says both websites have interactive maps and air quality reports that tell users how long they can be outside. Jackson County is prone to fires. Burns says the best thing people can do is be aware of fire and smoke, keep track of personal health, and check in on others. In Ashland, I'm Peyton Gast.
Protesters shouted down the chief sustainability officer of Microsoft on Friday at Seattle City Hall. Melanie Nakagawa was answering questions at Pacific Northwest Climate Week. Protesters criticized the company's rising greenhouse gas emissions and a new deal with Chevron for natural gas for a Texas data center. Nakagawa said the company has already made even bigger investments in clean energy.
Texas is a state where we have done over 4.7 gigawatts of clean energy already to date. It's a state where we have proven the ability to scale clean energy, renewable energy, to power operations.
And she said the company is looking to keep expanding clean energy across the U.S. and Asia. Last year, Microsoft's carbon footprint increased 25%, largely driven by data center growth. Nakagawa said most of the carbon impact comes from the company's suppliers. Next, we have meeting logs for public meetings happening across KMUN's listening area. This is not a comprehensive list. The Tillamook City Council meets in person and virtually today at 7 p.m. One item up for discussion is the proposed first reading of an ordinance about how recreational vehicles, trailers, and other types of vehicles are stored on public streets or on city property. The ordinance comes in response to concerns about how such vehicles are being stored or lived in for extended periods of time. The proposed amendments include a prohibition on overnight sleeping in vehicles on public property and establishes a 72-hour parking limit. For more information about how to access the meeting or go to the meeting agenda, visit the city's website. The Astoria City Council also meets tonight at 6 p.m. in person and online. More information is available at the city's website. The Wheeler City Council meets on Tuesday at 6 p.m. The council is expected to discuss short-term rentals, among other items. For more information, visit the city's website. The Tillamook County Board of Commissioners meets Wednesday at 9 a.m. in person and online. More information can be found at the county's website. Local and regional news is brought to you by our news partners and by the KMUN News Team. For more local and regional news, go to kmun.org/news.